Well, good afternoon and welcome to today's Conversations. This is your host, Michael Stone. You're listening to KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City and 105.1 FM in Truckee, translator K286AN. I want to thank all of you before we start this amazing show we have coming up with Paul Blank. He's a doctor who wrote How Everyday Products Make People Sick, so stay tuned for that. But I want to thank you all for your support. Last week we had an amazing pledge drive. You really showed up. If anyone wants to continue to support that, we still aren't quite at our goal yet, so you're welcome to do that. I know one person that was listening got a dinner with Amy Goodman, and what a treat. So if you'd like to just be an angel and join us or go to dinner with Amy Goodman, why don't you give the office a call at 265-9073. Also this week, and the community calendar at Cooper's Ale Works in Nevada City, Wednesday Johnny, tomorrow Jam, Friday Frequency, Friday 9 p.m., Saturday Nevada County Regulators 9 p.m. Also this week at the Center for the Arts downtown Grass Valley, Thursday 8 p.m., Loudon Wainwright with Lucy Wainwright and Roche Empty Opening. Also Saturday, the Phoenix Band and String Ensemble present a musical tribute to Dan Fogelberg. More information, 274-8384. Also, Friends of Hospice celebrates their 10th anniversary for Butterfly Garden of Remembrance from Saturday through Monday. That's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Benefit will be for Hospice of the Foothill, offering the community a place to express the loss of their loved ones, with butterfly stakes placed in the garden above Hooper and Weaver in Nevada City. For more information, call 274-5174. I am going to give my guest a call here, and I will be right back. Enjoy, Sophia. Yes, let the healing of the earth begin. A very appropriate topic for our guest today. Dr. Paul Blank, MD, is a professor of medicine and endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, where he's been on the faculty since 1988. He currently serves as chief of the Division of Occupational Environmental Medicine, board certified in internal medicine, occupational medicine, and medical toxicology. He also serves as associate medical director, California Poison Control System, San Francisco Division. He's authored numerous scholarly publications on the subject of toxic exposures and illness, and he's the author of How Everyday Products Make People Sick. Paul, welcome to Conversations.
Oh, happy to be here.
Great to have you. A topic that I think we all need to pay more attention to, and I just want to put a plug for your book, How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. Let's start out at home, where we all are, because there's so many things there that are toxic. Tell us about some of the things that you've been discovering in the home over the many years that you've been working on this and the kind of impact they're having on people's health.
Well, one of the things that I think comes up quite frequently are mishaps with bleach-containing products and mixes of hypochlorite bleach with other common household cleaners. That's certainly a big one in terms of people with acute illness and sometimes lingering symptoms afterwards.
That's when people mix, chlorine bleach with some kind of cleaning product, and it creates another kind of gas that they're susceptible to,
well,
right?
Basically, it's when people mix hypochlorite bleach was an acid-containing product. I think a lot of people are aware that you're not supposed to mix bleach with ammonia, but we don't have that many ammonia-containing products around anymore. But what has become quite popular are a whole variety of tile cleaners and related cleaning substances, all of which have various kinds of acids. Some have dilute hydrochloric acid, some phosphoric acid, and others. And there are also people who misguidedly think that since vinegar is natural, they can mix that with bleach and get a more effective cleaner. What they get is a little chlorine gas release.
And what happens when they breathe this chlorine gas?
Well, chlorine is a well-established irritant gas. In fact, it was first brought into widespread use as a war gas in World War I. So it causes burning of the eyes, the mouth, throat, the lungs, and with severe exposure can actually take somebody to an intensive care unit.
Wow. Other household products that people may not be aware of that have been causing problems?
Well, certainly among hobbyist enthusiasts, there are a variety of potential problems. One of the ones that I highlight are the use of two-part glue systems. Many people are familiar with epoxies, but now urethane glues have become very popular as well, and there are also methacrylate glues as another group. And all of these have in common that they are chemical entities that react as they're being used and form a solid, basically a kind of plastic. It's like having a little plastic factory in the home.
Now, we'll get a lot more into that when we get into the workplace with the glues, but I was wondering, and I didn't see anything in your book, but I may have missed it, about the whole thing of outgassing and sick homes and sick workplaces because of the carpets and the cushions and the flame retardants and all of those kinds of things. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, you bring up a whole variety of different issues, but I talk a little bit, actually, in the very beginning of main part of the book about how some of the things that we think are so new have really been around for a long time. And one of the issues I think that has smoldered along for some time is the issue of enclosed buildings and sort of non-specific health complaints that may be related more to lack of appropriate air turnover than anything else. And this really is not an issue in people's homes. This is more in large constructed office buildings. In the foreword to the book, the book is now in an expanded and updated edition that just came out a few months ago, and in that I do talk a bit about some of the increasing concerns related to flame retardants and potential exposures in a variety of settings that can include the home, it can include industrial settings, and in particular the highest levels of these exogenous chemicals have been reported to people who are involved in recycling of computer parts, because it turns out that computers are heavily impregnated with flame retardants. And these are persistent chemicals, polymers with lots of bromine in them, as it turns out.
Annie Leonard was on our show recently from down in your area, and was talking about how we dip our pillows and our bed things in these incredible flame retardants, and she said something, you'd think we'd find a better way to keep our head from catching on fire. But seriously, we are sleeping with our head against these flame retardants. Have you had some issues with that, people coming in?
No, that's not. And, you know, one of the things with low-level environmental exposures is it's not something that people in general are going to ever come in to seek medical care and say, I think the problem I have is related to some ubiquitous low-level exposure, and it's almost impossible in an individual person to establish a relationship. These are things that need to be studied on a group level in epidemiologic approaches. I think there has been the most established, I think, concern, believe it or not, in terms of some of these flame retardants has been an association between thyroid disease and house cats, which apparently is rampant and something of an epidemic, and the possibility that this is related to contamination, particularly of cat food sources, with these materials.
Right. Well, we have a lot of the, what was the additive to make it look like it had more protein you wrote about?
Oh, that's the melamine. And then some dog food got contaminated with that, as well as, of course, childhood formula in China itself. That was not imported to the United States. I think there were some limited exports, but not particularly to the United States.
Well, what about these toys, Paul? That we've had, you know, a lot of toys on the lookout scene here in the last couple of years. What's happening with some of the not just lead, but there's some other, I can't remember the name
of
it.
Cadmium.
Cadmium, yes.
Actually,
right.
That's really a great way of highlighting the failure of some of our regulatory agencies, and the regulatory agency, which is really responsible for household products, is an entity called the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which most people have never really heard of because they're so massively ineffectual that they just even aren't on people's radar screens. So people know about the EPA and OSHA, but they've never heard of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Its dogma is that they should almost never have any enforceable standard, that everything should be voluntary on the part of industry. And, of course, they've taken the same approach with the Chinese by reaching a gentleman's agreement that the Chinese will stop exporting lead-contaminated toys, but not having anything like the kind of inspection system that could help make sure that that's really happening. So most of the leaded toy problems have been actually brought to light by advocacy groups that have paid out of pocket for their own testing.
Now, as far as I can see from the CPSC, is that they actually do no real regulation. It's all either, like you said, a gentleman's agreement with China, or recommendations that they should do something. They can't. They don't even have any policies for labeling the contents, as far as I can see.
Well, they have the power to do it, and they have done it at times, but really very sporadically and only under a great deal of pressure, and then often will come out with an approach to control and then water it down very quickly or backstep. They've really been terribly flawed.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the regulatory agencies, the FDA, OSHA, EPA, and CPSC, I'd like to move a little bit towards the workplace, because there are some real toxic things happening there that are not being regulated and take forever to even make anything happen on them. Can you just give us some of your stories? I mean, you have so many of them, but highlighting some of the main things, like chlorine, for instance.
Well, I think even a better example and a more recent example has been the issue of diacetyl, a chemical which is an artificial butter flavorant, widely used, and came.
That's the popcorn butter, right?
Attention, right, in microwavable artificial butter flavored popcorn. Became clear almost 10 years ago that this chemical was causing severe and sometimes fatal lung disease in the workers in the factories making this product. And despite that, federal OSHA to this day has not really come up with any kind of standard particular to this chemical, let alone, you know, banning it altogether. What finally happened was, in terms of microwavable popcorn, a case of the same disease was documented in a heavy consumer of popcorn. A friend of mine in Colorado treated this patient who came in with an obscure lung disease, the etiology, the cause of which was not clear, and My friend asked him a million questions and couldn't get to the bottom of it. It just was that he was about to leave. She said, well, just one last question. You don't have anything to do with popcorn, do you? Because she'd already taken his work history and knew that he, I don't know, did some kind of benign work as a salesman or something. And he said, oh, well, my friends call me Mr. Popcorn. I go through four packages of microwave popcorn a day, and nothing I like more than to stick my face right in the popcorn just as it's out of the microwave. And once news of this case became public, the popcorn makers in about 48 hours withdrew this chemical from their product line because, of course, the potential liability from a consumer action is far greater than that from an employee. You know, employees are actually banned from suing their employers under workers' compensation.
They're actually banned from suing them under workers' comp?
That's correct. It's a no-fault insurance. You can bring action against some kind of third party that supplied your employer, but that's not so straightforward.
Well,
so all of the asbestos litigation, for example, has been against the maker of asbestos, not the person who hired the people who got exposed on the job, not the shipyard owners, etc. So, we still have this chemical in the workplace. It's just not in the popcorn business. It's in other things, and the companies that make these flavorants still produce this, and there still is no new regulation either from national or California OSHA, which has probably been the most active group looking at this.
Well, let's jump into that since it keeps coming up. Why? Why is that happening? Why are there new regulations? Why is the FDA and OSHA and EPA and CPSC not regulating these things and protecting the citizen safety?
Or why not as aggressively as they might? Because it's not that they don't do anything. I think it's multifactorial. For one thing, these regulatory agencies have been starved of resources for years. We've just gone through 30 years of tightening resources for almost all of these agencies, and a general philosophy stronger under Republican administrations than Democratic, but under both of reducing the power and charge of these agencies. And secondly, the costs and benefits accrue to different groups. You know, the costs of controls are borne by manufacturers, and the costs of illness are generally not borne by manufacturers or industry, but by the general public.
Now, we've done a number of shows on things like GMOs, and one of the things that I discovered, which was quite shocking, was how much the government agencies are a revolving door with industry. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that has that can be a problem. I think for the Consumer Product Safety Commission, it's not been in that direction. It's actually been directly peopled with industry types rather than former regulators with the Consumer Product Safety Commission going off to industry jobs. It's not such a big, that's not really the issue with some of the agencies. I think for the EPA, they've gone through a long period of a compromise, and I think a lot of the scientific staff can get just downhearted in that kind of atmosphere, and it takes a long time to rebuild the kind of cadre that you need to do effective work. And then some agencies, for example, in California, the Department of Pesticide Regulation, I think the staff scientists are really dedicated and superb, but the higher-level managers view their client as being, I think, the pesticide manufacturers and agribusiness rather than agricultural workers, the environment, and the general public. So it's not really because the staff on the ground are not dedicated and doing the best that they can, but often their best efforts are thwarted higher up the chain of command.
Yes, I had an opportunity to work for several years with the California EPA as a consultant, and it's interesting the small window that you have between elections to actually get anything through or anything done. But the, you know, the thing that I keep saying, you know, in the why, you know, why does it take so long? You know, we think about the lobbyists and how some of these cases, you know, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Ecuador in the Chevron Texaco case there, which I've forgotten how many years it is now, but somewhere close to 20 years, has been going on. In fact, people may not know this, but in that particular case, the filmmaker who did Crude, I think this is an important piece of news, actually, that did the movie Crude, which is a very, I think, important and revealing movie about this, was just subpoenaed and told he had to turn over all the hundreds of hours. So now what little free media that we have is also being oppressed with these market lobbyists and people in the market that are able to command so much power. And it's the same thing in these regulatory agencies in trying to, I know what you're saying is true, Paul, that there are great staff people and toxicologists and people throughout the industry who are really dedicated, but they can't get anything done. So where do people go when they need relief from these kinds of things?
Well, I think that it sounds trivial in a way, but I think that people have to be working through their elected officials and holding their nose to the grindstone, because when elected officials put pressure in the right direction, things start to happen. So that's clearly an important issue. I know that a lot of people are very concerned about personal behavior and buying green and what should I do personally, and I think that has a role, but it's not a panacea and it's not a substitute for protections at the societal level. You know, we don't every time we turn on the faucet, we don't feel we have to send off a sample for cholera bacterial culture. You know, we've come to expect that our drinking water going to be safe from that kind of bacterial contamination, and I think we have the same right to believe that we'll be protected from toxic chemical exposures, or that we shouldn't have to independently send a toy off for lead testing if we buy it in a toy shop, that we should have a guaranteed supply of safe consumer products.
Well, certainly we should, but if you, you know, you cover a lot of history of how far back these things go, some of them to the 1600s, 1700s, that some of these issues have been around, and yet it appears that often the industries themselves get off. I mean, just like you can't sue your employer, and so it's very hard for the individual to be able to take any action against a lobbyist.
That's correct. I'm not suggesting that, but it's very hard for the individual with individual action to also protect themselves effectively either, I think. And certainly you can't not choose not to breathe the air because there's an air pollution incident, you know.
Right, and well, the other thing is too is the discrepancy between the poor and the richer areas, and you talk about globalization of toxic threats, but that's a whole other area of that. But look at where are all the pollution plants? They're in the poor neighborhoods. Where are people getting the toxic dump sites? Where are people? It's where they can't fight, or they're the poorer areas. And that's a discrepancy. Do you have any thoughts about how to try to bridge that gap? Because the gap between the rich and the poor continues to grow.
Well, I don't have any easy solutions. I think that to the extent that income disparities can be narrowed, that solves a whole series of problems. Because of course, the major health decrements that are associated with economic gradients are not, in fact, probably environmental. That may just be the icing on the cake, but a whole series, or depending on how you define environmental, but there's certainly a whole series of health deficits that go along with lower socioeconomic status that have to do with cardiovascular disease and other things which are maybe environmental to the extent that they're related to diet and other things, but are not environmental chemical issues per se.
Well,
you know that would be a side benefit of narrowing such differences, but there'd probably be far greater health benefits in other ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just think of poor areas. Most people buy their groceries at a liquor store, as opposed to people being able to get non-pesticide-free, natural, organic food. I mean, we could go on and on
right.
and on about that.
And I think there are, you know, there are a whole group of epidemiologists who are starting to take a look at this from a more holistic point of view, that is to say, what are area level variations and what are the contributors of both socioeconomic status on the personal and the area level and the interplay. So I think that there's room for work in all of these areas. I think one of the issues about some of the egregious occupational and consumer product hazard stories is that they're sort of equal opportunity dangers, and so you can get everybody's attention.
Well, they are if you're exposed to it.
That's right.
But, you know, in poor areas, you've got a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio of asthma, for instance, which in most cases is due to pollutants in the air and toxins that they're taking. Of course, that's true, and in the bigger sense, and let's talk about the bigger sense a little bit, Paul, because I was really interested in hearing your thoughts on the whole globalization of toxic threats. We talked a little bit about the toys and things, but...
Well, it's a two-way street, I can say that, because...
Yep.
Yes, we've imported hazards, but we also export hazards, and in terms of industrial processes, there's sort of been a downhill gradient for a whole series of hazardous, manufacturing techniques that have been exported from Japan to Korea and from Korea to mainland China and so forth. Sort of down it goes, and the whole issue of exportation of materials for recycling, much of which occurs in China and India, and as I mentioned a little while ago, some of the highest levels of flame retardants in blood have been shown in, for example, Chinese computer recycling workers. It can, of course, be internal as well. There was this very interesting case of radiation poisoning last month reported from India, which the initial thought was that it must have been some kind of imported radiation-contaminated metal waste that got into the Indian market, and it turned out to be something that was sold off by an Indian university and then cut up in little pieces and marketed. So, the stuff can happen internally as well. The United States has been one of the countries that has opposed an international treaty on the transportation of hazardous waste, by the way.
Mm. I'm wondering how much... And you're out in the field talking to these people. How much of this industrial pollution do you think is actually done with malice or any forethought? And how much of it is just people uneducated?
I think there's a mix. I think that there also appears to be a kind of collective amnesia where a hazard gets discovered and then something happens about it, and then 20 or 30 years later, the same hazard seems to reappear again, as if there was no memory of what had gone on before. So there's an element of that. Part of what I describe with industry is kind of the equivalent of the Kubler-Ross stages of death and dying. You know, initially there's denial, and then there's a kind of anger at whoever, blew the whistle, and then there's kind of bartering about, well, okay, how about if we only let 5,000 people die instead of 50,000? And then finally there's some kind of closure on it, but often that doesn't seem to stand the test of time, and there are various ways this gets worked around. And partly it's related to greed, and partly stupidity, and partly inefficiency. I mean, it's all of it.
Yeah. In your book, if you just tuned in, I'm talking to Dr. Paul Blank, author of How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. You talk about, in your book, the revisionist history of environmental protection. Say a little bit about that, please.
Well, it's this kind of, in its broadest brush, it was the sort of Woody Allen treatment in Sleeper, you know, where the guy wakes up and suddenly finds out that cigarettes and sugar are good for you. But usually it's not done that lightheartedly. It's basically saying, all these people said the world was going to end in 1960, with the Silent Spring, and we still have birds in the spring. So how bad can it be? I think we're actually seeing this happening right now with global warming. You know, that there's enough of a counterattack that you tell the big lie often enough, and people will start to believe it. So you whatever way you can, you try to attack the validity of these things. And I think that there's been that attempt with environmental risk. And we're just seeing it again just prior to this huge oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico. So, even the current administration was promoting offshore drilling, and hey, it's not so bad, and people overblew this thing, and the Exxon Valdez was a one-off event, and the Santa Barbara oil spill, but that doesn't really count, so forth. And so people rewrite history, and if you don't know your history, you don't know what's being rewritten.
Yeah. Just a thing about the climate deniers, they happen to be, for a major part, funded by and the same people that were working with the tobacco industry. And they're not presenting facts, they're just trying to confuse the issue. We've had several people on talking about that. I want to talk about the Gulf spill a little bit, because it is so timely. And what's your prediction of the impact of that on the the whole Gulf Coast and Cuba and the Keys? You've been around these oil spills before. What's your thought about the health impacts?
Well, I think that there's a lot of concern, but I don't think the parameters are well defined. There was a large oil spill in Spain that didn't get much play here in the United States. This is, I think, 20 years ago or so, and the Spanish actually did a lot of research on various health effects related to that, and there was a surprisingly more public health impact than one might have thought. I don't think anyone has any question about the impact on the ecosystem, leaving human health aside. So this is obviously evolving to be a major disaster. I think that the lack of information has certainly hampered people's ability. If we can't even get the data, certainly the scientists who are close to it, as far as I've read, have had a great deal of difficulty getting information. The Natural Resources Defense Council has been in the past, and in this event too, has been quite active in looking into this, and I'll probably be looking to what they promulgate in terms of information.
Yeah. Another area that we haven't talked about that you address in your book are the occupational diseases like carpal tunnel and burnout and those types of things. Would you just give us a little of what's happening, the history of that, and how that's expanding also?
Well, I mean, I think one of the points that I was trying to make with that is also we think of this as being so hyper-modern, but in fact carpal tunnel has been around for a long time. It's just gone by different names. So in the 19th century, there were a variety of different complaints that seem to have a lot of overlap with what we call today carpal tunnel syndrome, including seamstress's hand and scrivener's hand, which was a disease in people who had to do hand copying, just like our association of carpal tunnel with modern keyboards and mouse work. That was a disease which seemed to have some relationship to the introduction of steel pointed pens, or, you know, these are still fountain pens, but as opposed to quills, because quills, if you apply too much pressure, break in your hand, and steel tipped pens, you can use a lot of pressure, and it's partly that pressure that's associated with developing the kinds of nerve damage that is characteristic of carpal tunnel syndrome. So really the issue there is that whenever people don't control the pace of their work, but the pace is set externally, particularly piecework or other, the moral equivalent of piecework, which is what a lot of self-employed information technology workers deal with, then you're prone to get these kinds of problems.
In your book, How Everyday Products Make People Sick, you spend a lot of time talking about glue and associated things with glue. We mentioned earlier just a little bit about it, but in from the industrial point of view, it's got quite a long history. Can you share with us a little bit about the history of that and some of the outgrowths from it and what happened when, of course, we used up the rubber in World War II?
Well, I mean, the history of glue was that for about 2,000 years it was this fairly benign substance where you cooked animal parts until they were soft and disintegrated, and then the stuff that you got from the bones was glue. And in the 19th century, they figured out that they could take rubber, natural rubber in this case, and dissolve it with potent solvents and use that as glue, rubber cement, what we call today rubber cement. And unfortunately, the solvent that was the preferred one was benzene, which very quickly after its introduction was linked to first to severe fatal anemia and then later to leukemia. But despite the fact that this link was established to leukemia in the 1920s, it took until the 1980s until this was regulated as a cancer-causing agent. And even then, there was about a 10-year hiatus because the Supreme Court of the United States threw out the OSHA standard on benzene, saying they didn't have enough scientific data. So it took them 10 years to come back with the stricter standard they wanted. And even that strict standard, you could make some arguments about who it protected and who it didn't. And then there were, as we've gone through various generations of solvents, there have been other problems, such as peripheral nerve damage from the solvent hexane, which was a very popular substitute, both for natural rubber and then for synthetic rubber glue. Until we've gotten now to this new generation of super glues, and their problems are somewhat different. They are sensitizing agents, and so they will cause skin problems and, in particular, asthma. And even the word glue has come to have a broader meaning because we have glues, but we have sealants that are very closely related to glues and all kinds of coating materials, and in particular, urethanes, which have really become almost ubiquitous in their applications. I don't know when the last time somebody you knew broke a limb, but the cast that they got probably wasn't with plaster. It was probably made from polyurethane.
Right.
They're a lot lighter, and the person who has the polyurethane cast is pretty unlikely to get to be made allergic to urethane because of that. But the person who applies those casts day after day after day is at risk of getting sensitized.
Now, isn't PVC also an outgrowth of this industry?
Not directly. Mm-hmm. The PVC and all the other plastics are outgrowths of the modern polymer industry.
That's right.
And they're not completely unrelated, but they're somewhat different, I would say, because the uses of the plastic polymers are in a different direction by and large. And most of the polymers of that plastic type, people aren't polymerizing them as civilians. They're being polymerized in large factories. Though the problems for consumers, as it turns out, seem to relate to the additives to the plastics, the plasticizers and other materials because of plastic polymer on its own is often useless because it's too brittle or too soft, and so all these other additives are become part of it, and that's where the controversies related to bisphenol A and other materials come from that aspect.
Right. One of the things that's really on the rise, I don't have the statistics of it, but it's Alzheimer's, or if you listen to radio talk shows, just flat out craziness. at least, not this one particularly.
No, God forbid.
But you talk about carbon disulfide, which is not something that most people know anything about. Can you share a little bit about what that is and why we should know about it?
Well, it's a chemical which has been around from the very earliest days of synthetic chemistry. So, you know, it's from the late 1700s, early 1800s, and has had two lives, really. Its first life was in the early rubber industry in the 19th century, where it was used in a particular kind of vulcanization that was applied to small consumer products. In fact, the early condom industry was based on this. And then a second life and a much bigger one in the modern viscose rayon industry. And the thing about carbon disulfide, it's a very interesting toxin, but in high-level, short-term exposures, it makes people insane. And then with longer, lower-level exposure, people develop neurologic disease, even Parkinsonism, as well as cardiovascular disease and stroke. So it's not at all present in the final rayon product that consumers buy, but people who make rayon are by definition at risk, and it's seeped its way into other things. So it's a breakdown product of a very widely used agricultural chemical. And it's a breakdown product of the alcohol treatment drug Anabuse. So it's out there, and it's an air contaminant released by certain manufacturing facilities.
So these are more manufacturing, along with some of the dusts and the fumes that you talk about. Also, anything you'd like to say about those?
You mean about just dust and fumes in general?
In general, you were talking about some of them being toxic and some of the effects. Obviously, asthma was one of them. But
I mean, you could choose any toxic endpoint that you want. You're likely to find one of these industrial processes that's associated with it. And often, in fact, it's work-related disease that gives us insights into so-called idiopathic disease in the general population in terms of mechanism of disease. Despite that, of course, there's millions of dollars available for research of genetic associations with disease and very little money for research on occupational disease. Probably because you can't change people's genetics, but, you know, God forbid you should find out that an industrial process is hazardous. That would be probably bad for business.
Yeah, exactly. Well, also, one of the businesses is the new toxins being developed every day. You know, how do you get rid of these things? You know, some of them might break down fairly quickly, but some of them, I think, have a very long shelf life. What's being developed, and how do we dispose of these things?
Well, badly, I guess, is the easiest answer. And unfortunately, our solutions to control are very, very, very rarely simply banning a process or a product, which would, of course, be the most effective control measure for a lot of these things. But that's almost never done. So, for example, coming back to the example of diacetyl, the chemical associated with disease in popcorn, although it was removed from microwavable popcorn, it's still in commerce. And really, probably the solution to its toxicity is simply banning it. But I doubt that's going to happen.
Yeah. Paul, we had a lot of calls come in while we were talking, and I was holding off. But if it's all right with you, I'd like to open the lines if anybody would like to call in and ask a question, particularly about some specific chemical or toxic threat that they're interested in. And while we're waiting for someone to call in, the number is 530-265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. I'd like to move this into what can we, the individual consumer, do about this? I mean, this is a threat to our health, to our children's health, to the health of the planet. It's a global thing, and sometimes as an individual you think, what can I do about this?
Well, I think we've talked a little bit about this. I think it's in some ways I'm somewhat sanguine about what the individual person can do in terms of their own shopping behavior or their own household. I mean, clearly there are some simple things one can do. I think it's easy enough to be conscious of the risk of mixing different products together, and so I think that's a prevention step that's easily carried out. And I think that the idea that you should never use a more complicated approach if a simple one will do is a good idea. So it's hard to understand what the real societal benefit is of having a coffee mug handle glued together in a way in which two gorillas can't pull it apart. So if old-fashioned glue will work, why not do that? If soap and water will work for cleaning, why use some potentially irritating product from a spray can?
What about labeling? How can we get involved? I mean, so many things that should be labeled, it's not mandatory that they are labeled.
Well, there again, I think what we need a change at the societal level by putting some teeth into the Consumer Product Safety Commission, certainly, because they're the ones who are responsible for much of the labeling. The other labeling does fall to the Environmental Protection Agency, depending on what the material is, or to the FDA.
So who do we write to? We write to our local representatives, state representatives?
Yes, and make clear our views that occupational environmental protection is a priority, and that if one is going to invoke cost-benefit, then you better make sure that the cost and benefits accrue to the same people.
Great. Let me just take this one call coming in here. Whoops. I waited too long. Okay. Caller, you can call back then. So we're running close to the end, Paul. I want to again plug your book, How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace, Dr. Paul Blank. Paul, there's places also that I'm curious about, just came to mind, like in Marin County, which you live down towards that area.
Oh, in San Francisco, yeah.
In San Francisco, yeah. There's this huge epidemic for the last few years in breast cancer. Has there been anything show up positive about the impacts of some of the toxins in that area or the lifestyle? Because that's unusual that it shows up in a wealthy area as opposed to a poor area.
Well, I haven't kept track of what the latest epidemiologic data are in terms of breast cancer incidence in Northern California or in particular counties. But that is an area in which there are pretty active community-based groups that have been involved, and there's been a fair amount of research resources devoted to it as well. But I don't have any news updates on that subject.
I have a hot tub, and about a year ago, I was trying a new chemical. Unbeknownst to me, there was already some chlorine in the water, and I poured it in, and it turned green, and was putting off a horrible gas, which I got away from very quickly.
But I had that sounds like chlorine gas.
Yeah.
That you released.
Oh, absolutely.
But that is a green gas.
Right. And what I had a hard time finding was the Center for
the Poison Control Center.
Poison Control Center. How do people find that? If there's just suddenly an emergency, you know, off the top of your head, how do I take care of this? What do I do if I do something like that?
The 800 numbers are widely available, and I would just make sure that you have it in the same place where you would have
fire
other things right now.
Yeah.
Or on speed dial. People, I think, with kids, young kids in the home, know that number.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Paul, we're getting towards the end here, and I just want to thank you for your great work that you're doing and for keeping us informed. And also, I don't think you have a website, but, well, we do have somebody calling. Let me take one. Oop.
They're gone, too.
You know what? I think we're still in pledge drive, so I think that maybe people are calling in to give money. That must be what's happening here.
Well,
so.
That's good, too.
Yeah, that's very good. In fact, I will make a plug about that in a minute. But I just want to thank you, Paul. It's a wonderful book. I think everyone should have this book available and at least share it and read it and talk to people in their community about the toxins and things that we have going on here.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me. And, you know, people can get the book at their local bookstore or through the University of California Press website or through some of the large book search engines, if that's their preference.
Fabulous. Paul, so good to be with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks so
much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Paul Blank, How Everyday Products Make People Sick. Well, let's see. I want to thank here all of you, of course, for your incredible support. The pledge drive, as I said earlier in the show, was a big success in terms of conversations. We're still a number of $1,000s short of our goal, so I want to invite you to call up the front desk and just, you know, give them some money. Say, hey, I got an extra pile of money sitting here. And it's 265-9073. Also, there's this great opportunity, which one of our people took last time, was to go have dinner with Amy Goodman in New York. And that's for a $2,000 pledge for somebody who wants to get the real scoop and spend the evening and day with Amy Goodman. So give us a call if you'd like to do that. The other thing is, I'm going to put some music on here. And... And I'm going to find the schedule, and I'll be right back here. So tomorrow we're doing a special from 12 to 1, and that's going to be on the climate change conference that I covered in Bolivia with some material you haven't heard before. So that's something that I highly recommend if you can listen to that. There's some great interviews pulled together for that. So that's a special tomorrow, noon to 1. June 1st, we're going to have Elizabeth Satoris. She's the person who is best known for her talking about the transformation of the butterfly and the imaginal discs. She'll be calling us from Malta. Somewhere in the Balearics, anywhere in the middle of the Mediterranean, where she works as a biologist. And then we have Thomas Greco on June 18th, who will be talking about the end of money and the future of civilization. So we have a lot of great people coming up in the future. And please tune in at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays, 1 to 2.